The Sizo and Bob Welsh Experience podcast. Aye. Professor Friedman, thank you so much for joining us on SMWX.
Thank you, Sizo. Thanks for having me.
It's a great privilege to have you on the channel, and thank you for this important book, which I have just introduced. Prisoners of the Past, South African Democracy and the Legacy of Minority Rule. A very interesting and important intervention. And I want to start where you start, which is an interesting position with which I agree, actually, that it seems that there are two schools of thought prevailing in South African discourse right now. One school that suggests that absolutely nothing has changed, and one school that suggests that everything has changed. And you seek to carve out a position between those schools, acknowledging important advancements made since 1994, but also recognizing the stagnancy of this democratic moment. Take us through why you think both extreme approaches, as it were, get something wrong.
Well, I think the easiest one to demolish is the idea that everything has changed. If you look at the poverty statistics, if you look at the inequality statistics, the Gini coefficient, if you look at the racial redistribution of managerial jobs, and so we could go on. The idea that everything has changed is simply not sustainable. I argue in the book that it goes deeper than that. It shouldn't be particularly interesting to remind South Africans that racism still exists, that poverty still exists, and that inequality still exists. But I think what
some
I
of
find
our observers
striking
haven't yet figured that out. But hey,
yes, no. But they're probably not going to figure it out because you and I write about it.
This is true.
But I think some of the deeper continuities are what strikes me. And perhaps to illustrate it with something which doesn't really make it into the public debate very much. I'm struck by the fact that we have this bizarre jobs debate in this country in which everybody is going to create 8 million jobs or 6 million jobs or whatever the number may be. All of which, of course, means formal jobs. So the idea that you can only make your living in a decent way in a glass and concrete building is a very old idea in this country. It describes white society in the 1960s. And yet that is the standard by which we measure ourselves. We don't ask what I think is the obvious question, which is how do we support and enable people who are making their livings in backyard shacks and on pavements and all the other places where South Africans make their living. In a sense, I argue in the book that what we've been doing as a society, what our elites have been doing over the last 27 years, is trying to shovel as many black people as possible into something which whites created and which whites and the new black elite don't seem to think we ought to change. And if that's the reality, you're going to have a great many continuities. The second argument that nothing has changed. The argument I'm trying to make is some very essential patterns have not changed, and we've just been discussing that. We still have this insider-outsider divide. We still have a racial pecking order, etc. But I don't think you can sustain the argument that nothing has changed. If you have a look at an obvious reality like the fact that there are, a point I always make, that there are probably 5 million South Africans or around about there who wouldn't be alive today and if nothing had changed, because they wouldn't have won free entry retrovirals to treat HIV and AIDS. Or the fact that we have millions of people who are doing very creative things with social grants. And look, there's also this very hotly contested phenomenon called the black middle class. And I endorse in the book many of the, you know, this idea that many people in the black middle class are one paycheck away from poverty. I accept that, but I don't think we can deny the fact that opportunities have opened up which were not there before.
Sure.
And of course, there is a chapter in the book which I think will hopefully be hotly debated, in which I try to suggest that a lot of the blame placed on institution is a bit misplaced, yes, in the sense
we will come to that.
Anyway, my position is that I think that there's, you know, anything that could have been done or should have been done that's been stopped by the Constitution, I think it's been stopped by other things. So let me leave it at that for now.
No, absolutely. And I think you make the argument persuasively. I know our two books, perhaps flatteringly for me, have been compared in various reviews. And maybe my book titled The New Apartheid is more provocatively titled. And those who just look at the title assume that I'm in the camp that you suggest, where people think nothing has changed. But I think you show quite clearly up front that, you know, this idea that South Africa is the same place that it was before 1994 is really untenable. And we need to start from that honest departure point before we launch the critique.
I think that's right.
As I say, the section on the Constitution is also really interesting. You bring us right up to date with various debates, but I'm going to tantalize my viewers with that and leave that to do a bit later, because I wanted to touch on something you mentioned earlier in your first response, which also caught me, which is this idea that you create about unspoken norms and unspoken aspirations which have taken root, and particularly this idea that there was agreement, if not outward agreement, at least internal agreement, that the goal for South Africa should be to open up white privilege. And you have this interesting section where you call it white privilege for all, open up white privilege for everyone who was barred from its privileges. And that view of what a good society looks like in many ways was shared on both sides of the 1994 or 1990s negotiating table. Talk us through how you arrived at that idea and the importance of this shared endpoint, which has stuck us in this path-dependent reality.
Well, I mean, as you know from having looked at the book, I mean, I try to illustrate this by what I guess we could call the tragedy of Alexander Township. And I think it's worth mentioning that because it does make it more graphic and it does make it more concrete. To cut a long story short, Alex was one of two or three places under apartheid in which black people had freehold rights. The apartheid state wanted to destroy that and to turn the entire township into a big single-sex hostel. And the residents' association successfully resisted that. And then when it came to when they'd successfully resisted that and it came to redeveloping Alex, the residents' association said, we want to turn Alex into a garden suburb. And they called in a whole bunch of white town planners from Wits to do this. And the town planners said, you can't do that because the size of Alex and the number of people in Alex is such that the only way you can do that is by pushing people out of the homes they're in, and you'll create masses of homelessness, etc. The residents' association said to the white planners, well, you live in garden suburbs, why not us? And the result was what we see. Alex is still living with that today. I mean, the displacement. So everything, on the one hand, everything that the town planners said was correct. On the other hand, the residents' committee's critique was also correct, in the sense that what the white planners went home to at night was totally unsustainable. Now, obviously, to let everybody off the hook at the Alex example, that was under apartheid. So you couldn't ask what I'm arguing are the obvious questions and make the obvious point, which is the critique of the way people were living across the divide in Sandton. And to say, which is surely true in a society like ours, that people in Alex cannot live decent lives if people in Sandton are living the kind of lives that they're living at the moment. But the problem is that, after 1994, the same paradigm became entrenched, so that what we were trying to do as a society is, so you had a corporate South Africa in which at the end of apartheid, I think six companies controlled 90% of the stock exchange. And so we spent 27 years trying to push as many black people as possible into those corporations. And obviously there aren't that many spaces. But what we should have been saying is, do you really want an economy in which a young in a township who has ideas and energy is going to forever be marginalized because 2% of the country control all those assets and control all those resources. So the real issue, what we should have been saying is what whites enjoyed under apartheid is unsustainable. You cannot extend to 100% of the population what 10% got by using guns and laws to suppress the other 90%. Mm. And we needed a serious discussion about what it was that was sustainable for everybody. And we never had that. And so that, as you say, we land up with white privilege for everybody, which lands up as white privilege for very few people on the material level, and which is also not entirely white privilege because whites are still privileged in relation to the black middle class and the black business class.
Yeah, absolutely. And it speaks to an interesting theme that runs through the book, even if not necessarily overtly articulated, about the importance of imagining different futures, which not only go beyond the formal requirements of a democracy, but go deeper into people's desires, their aspirations, the way they see what they think is good, and what they envisage a just South Africa to be. And it's fascinating to me that we spend so little time on that imaginative, creative aspect of South Africa. And in fact, you say it's untenable, but you also say that it's actually undesirable. I don't think we should want a South Africa where everyone has what white South Africans had in the 1970s. It would probably be hugely unsustainable in a number of ways. And so we hardly know what that South Africa looks like that isn't what we currently have, but isn't everyone living in a leafy suburb on a large Fordist plot.
Yeah, sure. No, and we haven't had that. It's one of the many conversations we didn't have in 1994. And of course, one of the themes of my argument is that, my argument is not what was done in 1994, but what was not done in 1994. And one of the things which was not done in 1994, besides a serious conversation about race, which in a sense, the centuries of racial domination were essentially outsourced to two clergymen. In the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, who was supposed to be expected to undo centuries of history on their own. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we did not discuss, as you say, is what kind of society did we really want? I mean, the Freedom Charter was an impressive document in its time, but documents of that sort have limits, and I think one of the limits of the Freedom Charter is actually, if you look very carefully at the Freedom Charter, really what is being demanded there is very much what whites have for everybody, and that's in a sense shows I think far more acceptance of the status quo than we would expect in what was supposed to be a major liberatory document.
One of the other interesting aspects of the book, still up front, is this way you dispel the idea of ANC dominance, where you set up the myth that the ANC is this dominant party, and in many ways, of course, it does enjoy great electoral or did enjoy great electoral majorities for a long time. But you say that even before this recent election, you know, there are vast swathes of suburban South Africa where the ANC hasn't been able to influence or make an impact politically. And I also wondered with this latest election, how that argument actually, you know, is further borne out by the recent facts.
Well, I think what interests me about the election is that, I mean, to me, this great anomaly about post-apartheid South Africa is that, and that does speak to the ANC's lack of dominance, actually, is that, you know, in a very crude sort of way, given that up until fairly recently, the townships and the shack settlements voted ANC and the suburbs voted DA or whatever else was on offer at the time. You would have expected the entire structures of municipal government to be delivering all sorts of goodies to people in townships and ignoring people in suburbs. Mm. But in fact, the reverse has happened, which doesn't mean, I mean, let's not be crude about it. I'm not saying that people sit in municipal offices and say, how can we give more to folks in the suburbs? But the reality is that if you don't, and to change the underlying power relationships in the society, middle class people always have a lot more power than poor people and working class people. That's not rocket science. I mean, you know, we know that from every market economy in the world. And so that you have the situation where, you know, in this dreadful gulag where all these people are living because, you know, in suburban misery because they don't control the state. I mean, you not only have total freedom of speech, which doesn't exist in many townships, you not only have a much greater, higher level of public service, but of course you're also linked into the people who control the economy. And therefore, one of the great continuities of post-apartheid South Africa is that the suburbs remain the places where there are good services, their affluence and their freedom of speech, and the townships remain. You know, remember under apartheid, as an aside, which I do remember in the books, you know, there's a lot of forgetfulness on the white side of the equation. I mean, whites not only lived very well under apartheid, they had a functioning democracy. You know, there was a bit of vote rigging here and there, but as long as you didn't show too much interest in what Black people were experiencing, you know, you could vote for the opposition, you could denounce the government, etc. And that, in a sense, is very much what we're dealing with today. You know, suburbs in which, you know, not only, which is fine, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, not only do they criticize the government the whole time, but I think, you know, if you stand up in a suburban meeting and say anything nice about the government, you probably don't get invited around for cocktails afterwards, etc. And you compare that with townships in which local, you know, Abaslali Basimjondolo in KZN, you know, Spurs and Gordy, who's the chair of Abaslali, is living in hiding because if he appears out of hiding, he might not survive, etc., etc. And of course, on the level of services, which, you know, there's this constant complaining about services, etc. I mean, you know, the basic reality that if you're in a suburb and the power goes out, not because of Eskom, because of the municipality or the street lights don't work, you pick up the phone and you yell, and usually it's dealt with. And we know that in inner cities and townships, that's not the case.
And sorry to depart from the book briefly, but do you think that recent results reinforce those patterns or might challenge them?
I mean, what interests me, sorry, I got carried away by my own train of thought.
No.
I think it changes anything in the suburbs. The DA lost ground in the suburbs, but essentially the suburbs were, you know, they shifted from the DA to Freedom Front Plus or from the DA to Herman Mashaba's party, et cetera, which is really not a significant departure from the DA. What is interesting to me, and which I think is something to watch, is what is this going to mean in townships and shack settlements? And my immediate pessimistic response is probably a great deal less than we think, because I think that there are some very entrenched power relationships there, which are not just going to disappear because of election results. You know, I think we need to remember the ANC has been dominant in townships and shack settlements in the sense that the disputes tend to be carried out within the ANC rather than between the ANC and somebody else. So you have these many examples of, you know, SACP activists demonstrating against an ANC mayor, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it's very important to remember that, you know, the real power structures in the townships are not the political party structures. They might use the political party structures. And so I think the election result, which is a big bugbear of mine, which nobody seems to is that I think that the election result has opened up opportunities for activism which weren't there before, because if you look at one of my authors that have influenced me, Partha Chatterjee, who writes about India, he describes how in slums in Kolkata, activists are able to play the political parties off against each other because the parties are competing for their votes. So that opens opportunities. But to get back to my previous example, I'm not convinced this is a good time. You know, this means that Skuzigodi can come out of hiding now, because I think that he's going to face the same power structure in an Etequini run by the ANC and IFP as he did before.
Well, what I think is interesting about that analysis, and also coming back to the book, is that often when people make the argument that the legacy of apartheid is still salient in the democratic present, they focus solely on economic factors and assume that, well, politics itself has made a fundamental transition. But it's actually not so much, it's not as clean as that. And one of the things that I think is becoming clear to me is that certain political actors have realized that they don't need a national majority in order to wield enough political power in order to constrain choices in a certain way. And the turnout differentials in suburbs and townships now mean that the DA and the Freedom Front Plus, and to some extent Herman Mashaba's party, which is a bit more ambiguous, may not hold majorities in many places, but they wield disproportionate power relative to the population because they just turn out their voters in those places at greater rates. And so the balance of power within municipal councils is then rendered different to the balance of power in the country itself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we're seeing this playing out today in various places. And that in itself is it's also part of, I don't know when you discussed separately. This insider outsider divide really is what shapes our politics. And I still maintain that politics in this country is insider politics. The people outside get to vote, and then they're expected to have things decided for them for the next 50 years. And if you look at the ANC, if you look at the governing party, the divide within the ANC, the factional divide that has been roiling the ANC for the last few years, that is very clearly a symptom of what I describe in the book, because in a sense, there are obviously nuances to this thing. The Ramaphosa group, the group that sort of Ramaphosa represents, are essentially the insiders. They're the people who got squeezed in. and that's who he speaks to. And that includes, to a certain extent, although they're junior outsiders, members of trade unions, people, factory workers, etc. Because one of the big divides in this country is, even if you get any sort of wage or salary or anything from a formal economy, then you are an insider. And obviously not insiders are, you know, I keep on making a point. That means that the chief executives of banks and the women who clean their offices are both insiders. And you can't possibly argue that those two people are equal in any way. But the Ramaphosa group, you know, stretching from the unions through to professionals, et cetera, the people who are inside, which doesn't mean, because all politics is inside, inside politics, the Zuma group is not the outsiders, but the Zuma group see an opportunity in the fact that they're outsiders. And so that is really what this fight is about, in my view. It's not this very crude thing about good guys and bad guys at all, but it reflects the fact that, you know, we still have an insider-outside society, and that divide runs smack bang through the governing party as well as through everything else.
No, absolutely. And that was one thing I enjoyed about the book is I think you've broken with many mainstream analysts, both in acknowledging the continued salience of race, which has seems to have fallen out of fashion to some extent.
We agree on this, but I mean, it's just, you know, it's like somebody not acknowledging that the sun has risen. I mean, it's just so obviously it runs right through the society.
But also, you know, breaking with this dualistic analysis of the ANC and the angels versus devils narrative, while not seeking to exonerate the so-called RET faction or whatever it's calling itself today, but also to say that, look, the great revival that we were promised has not arrived, and we need to figure out why that's the case, instead of pretending that, you know, Ramaphosa and those who back him just haven't figured it out yet. So let's come on to this constitutional question. Because I think this is one area where we disagree, and I'll just point readers to our respective books on this. But I'm interested in just hearing your side of the argument, as you can see, and as has become clear on this channel. This is not a Jeremy Paxman attempt to shout people down. It's more just an attempt to explore different arguments, and I think. You certainly grapple with a lot of the constitutional critique while suggesting that the Constitution is not an impediment or as much of an impediment to resolving South Africa's crises as many people think they are. Take us through why, despite suggesting South Africa is in quite a serious crisis, you nonetheless think that the Constitution is not the source or the predominant source of that crisis.
Yeah, look, what I do in the chapter on the Constitution is that I look at some of the voices who are offering critiques of the Constitution. Yeah. And there are some very fine thinkers among them. I mean, you know, formidable thinkers. I mean, you know, John Bodiri and Sanela Sabanda and Sepo Madlengozi, et cetera, I mean, these are people whose writing, I think, is very perceptive on a whole lot of issues. And that's why, in fact, I mean, just aside, that initially I thought it would be quite a short chapter. And the more I read, the more I became convinced it's a very long chapter, because there's a lot to engage with there. But I think the short answer to your question, the critique of the society which they offer in various ways, and of course, as you know, they're not coming all from the same perspective, and I do deal with that. The critique of the society I endorse, but where I think they fail, as does Carl von Holt, Jane Duncan, and others who've taken on, is that the argument goes something like this. You actually say, well, what is there in the Constitution which prevents radical redistribution, for example? Because we don't, you know, we've just gone through this whole land debate, et cetera. You know, very few people noticed that in section 25 of the Constitution, there's actually a clause 8, sub clause 8, I think it is, 8B or something, which says none of this applies if you can demonstrate that it is designed to rectify a historical racial injustice. So, I mean, it seems to me that at the very obvious, at the very most basic level, as Dikgang Moseneke says, and as Thembang Tobo has said, and others have said, that you could have done this for the last 27 years, or you could have, you know, if you tested it and gone to the Constitutional Court and you'd been subjected to some very narrow judges, well, then you could start talking about changing the Constitution. But nobody ever tried to do this. And it always comes down to the property clause, because in fact, there isn't a property clause is subject to that exception. Now, when you make that argument, the response, and if anybody's interested, I think the academic writing which develops this is Sanele Sabanda's writing, he's a legal scholar, is that the Constitution should have. So it's not it's not that the Constitution prevents things happening, it's that the Constitution doesn't enable things to happen. And I really worry about that because, as I point out in my response to Sabanda, basically what you're trying to do is you try to take issues out of democratic contestation, and you're trying to put them in the courts, etc. And to put it mildly, seeing that everybody on this side, in this argument, wants radical change, judges, to be quite frank, in the main are quite conservative people. And the law is quite a conservative instrument. A great deal of damage can be done, to progressive values by putting in the hands of judges that which should be in the hands of the people, if you can put it that way. I mean, there's a bit of an analogy in the sense, something I've written about in other books, etc., which is that, in 1994, there was an argument that, parliamentary democracy wasn't enough. We have to have all sorts of forums, etc., which enable people to, community police forums are the most well-known, etc. Now, one of the fascinating things about this is, and it gets back to my point about the suburbs and the township, is that who uses the community police forums? It's people in the suburbs who use them. Okay, people in the townships are on the wrong side of power relationships, which are not going to be sorted out by community police forums. So the analogy between the two is that in both cases, you're essentially saying, we've got a short circuit democracy in some way. And my experience is that not only in this country, but in many others, if you start short circuiting democracy in that way, the privileged gain, the elites gain because they know how to game the system. Everybody else doesn't. Remember that, I quoted in the book, the critique about rights, the wrong people try to enforce them. You have this endless group of privileged white people going to the courts and saying our rights are being enforced. The more you allow it to be jurisprudence and the more you allow it to be the court. I mean, obviously there's a very important role for jurisprudence in the courts. Nobody's arguing about that. But to me, if you're saying it's progressive to pack more and more things into the Constitution, it kind of starts reminding me, and some of us are old enough to remember this, in the 90s when a celebrated jurist who's very famous, etc., wanted to actually put something in the Constitution saying, there shall be affirmative action. And then somebody said, but what happens if people abuse it? And he said, no, well, we'll add a schedule saying that people are not allowed to, that becomes, and this is quite substantial figure we talk. So to me, I'm to be, to confess a prejudice, which I've tried to do, I've tried to explain in another book, I'm a gut Democrat. And I'm aware of the fact that there are power imbalances, and I'm aware of the fact that voting isn't enough, etc. But to me, the answer to the problem, which those colleagues are accurately identified is a different sort of politics. It's not a new constitution.
So, Stephen, just to end off, we've had an interesting exploration of your chapter on the constitution. Just to say to everyone, do make sure to get the book, because there's a lot we haven't covered, especially in the middle, where, you know, Professor Friedman deals with questions of path dependence, engages with Mamdani, talks about the negotiations. There's a real feast here. But at the end of the book, you come to essentially ways out of this path dependent situation in which we find ourselves, where the past keeps encroaching on our best efforts to eliminate its effects. And you end on the importance of negotiation. Now, one of the things that came to mind is that I wonder whether your remedy goes far enough, given that you've set up this this quite compelling structural and path-dependent problem. And it seems to me that even if we do get people around the table and they negotiate as hard as they can, it still seems to me that some things do need to be dispensed with. Why do you think that negotiation is the main way out? And won't that just lead to the same problem which we created in 94, where we tried to negotiate ourselves in some ways around some of these structural crises?
Yeah, look, just at one point, as I said earlier, on 1994, I think the constitutional negotiations were largely successful. I mean, I think they represented the balance of power at the time. And my critique of 1994 is not, as I say, the sort of trendy line is we didn't compromise too much, we didn't compromise enough, by which I mean we didn't compromise on the economy, we didn't compromise on the institutions of the society, and we should have done that, which is what I'm arguing we must go back and do now. I think the important thing to stress here, and I mean, obviously that, I mean, I understand where the criticism has come from, and I have a good deal of sympathy with it. Negotiation to me, is not, there seems to be a sort of mainstream notion of negotiation, or perhaps outside the mainstream as well, as something where people, who get on with each other, sit down and discuss the details of how they're going to tinker with things. And that's not what I mean about negotiation at all. Maybe I should write an extra chapter one day if they'd let me on what I think negotiation is and what I think it isn't. But to me, a process of negotiation is one in which, and so I do say in the book that it seems to me that the obvious place where this negotiation started was the government. And the way in which the government starts it is that it says, look, this is what we think ought to happen, which is not a tinkering approach. And then if you don't like the way we go to do things, then let's hear from you. And obviously that's not unlimited. We do have a set of, the much maligned constitution does set out a set of values. If you come to the negotiation table to discuss more and better and sophisticated ways to preserve white privilege, then that's obviously not permissible. But the best way to put this is, long ago I was a trade unionist, and a lot of my ideas have been, on negotiation have been formed by that. If you think of the average wage negotiation, which makes the headlines, etc., it's an exercise of power. There's nothing particularly friendly about it. It may well end in a strike. It may well end in both sides trying to use power against the other. But the difference between negotiation and simply acting unilaterally is that negotiation recognizes the power of the other side. And I think that is realistic. I certainly do not mean by this, let's just... get everybody around a table, and these dreadful things happen every time this country wins a sporting event, etc. We were all told to remember all the wonderful things we have in common and don't worry yeah. about the fact that we're living in poverty.
Yeah.
So to me, negotiation is a particular type of exercise of power. And I think that it recognizes certain realities which needed to be recognized. And, you know, you may recall, just as I engaged with Mamdani on state capture, I engaged with Harold Wolpe on this. And I think Wolpe on this issue, who of course was an ANC and an SACP intellectual, was very prescient, because what he said about the 1995 RDP white paper was absolutely correct, because, you know, the Government of National Unity came out with this thing and said, we all agree now. And he said, no, you don't all agree now. You all disagree now. And maybe you should be talking about what you disagree about rather than what you agree about. So, you know, I think that negotiation is a recognition of a certain reality, but I certainly don't want to imagine, you know, that this is like those things. It's certainly not like those things they used to do in the Mbeki administration and some of the things they do now in the Ramaphosa administration, where they get people in a room for 3 days and they sign some sort of inane declaration, etc. We're talking about something which could go on over the 3 or 4 years and which is going to be very tough and which is going to have people saying very nasty things about each other, but it's out in the open and it's a recognition that you do need to recognize the power of the other party to a certain extent. That's the argument for negotiation. But of course, just that the other point I do make is that I think that negotiation will only happen, that process will only happen if we win the battle of ideas to a certain extent. And that's where conversation, you know, books that we write and conversations like this are very important. Because unless there's a great deal of public demand for the kind of change we're talking about, then the process won't even start.
Well, Professor Friedman, thank you so much for joining us on SMWX, exploring your book, Prisoners of the Past, with us. Do go out and get this excellent and provocative book, and look forward to, I see you've, no sooner have you published this than there's a new one on the way.
There is.
Yeah.
The new one's out.
Oh, it's out. That's the COVID one. So, well, buy both.
But the COVID book is very much linked to this book, because the argument of the COVID book is that our response to COVID, it was shaped by the realities I describe in this book. So,
okay. Very good. Well, do check both of those books out. And Professor Friedman, thanks so much for your time. It was really great and a privilege to talk to you.
Thank you, Sizwe. I enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
The Sizwe Mbofu Welsh Experience podcast. Aye.